Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to episode number 129 of Mystic Music Podcast, the Millennial Throwback Machine. First of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to episode number 129 of my 60 Music Podcast, the Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is, I'm just give you a brief description of what this show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 25-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a 60 music fan slash expert slash nerd. And each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist in the 60s, put the show in two parts. First part of the show, talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, and do my own personality on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, where the who are the studio musicians in the track, whether it be the band members or the musician, studio musicians themselves, and also who are the singer, history behind the singers that sang the song, songwriters that wrote the songs, the producer that produced it, and the history behind the label the song was released on, and the year and month the song came out, and the peak position the song made up originally in the Billboard Hot 100 charts, and the label of the song was released on, the history behind that label, and where that label is located at, and where the studio the song is recorded at, where that studio is located at. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before you move on this week's episode of the podcast, I just want to say, if you had the chance to check out my last interview episode, thank you guys for listening to it. I know it was a long episode, so I appreciate anyone who tuned into that one, listened to it all the way through and didn't, you know, stop and go do something else. Or if you just listened to the whole thing, I appreciate you for doing that. So it's this week's episode is not going to be a two-parter. It's going to be all in one episode because I'm really going to do my best to keep this a shorter episode. So that way you guys can access it a little bit easier instead of just having to, you know, stop and listen to it and then not listen to it all the way through it in one sitting. Because I know you guys are getting pretty busy, you know, just the fact that cases are, you know, plummeting right now as far as COVID is concerned, and people are going back to work, and people are getting a lot busier now versus earlier in January. So I'm going to keep this a short episode. I'm going to do it all in one episode like I used to do before, and I'm going to keep it pretty short. I'm going to try to keep it under 35 minutes, but if I go over, that's okay. But really, this is a one-hit wonder, so there's not much to tell as far as history is concerned, but I'll talk about them. But probably one of my favorite one-hit wonders from the 60s. This song is incredible, and I can't wait to talk about it with you guys. And yeah, I'll keep you guys updated as to when I move over to Anchor. You know, when this podcast moves over to there. I haven't done it yet, but I will soon. And yeah, so let's get on with this week's episode. Okay, so let's talk about this week's song. You know, I've done British Invasion acts before on this podcast. But I've noticed that it's been a while since I've done one from the later part of the 60s, because I've done some from right when it was happening, like Peter and Gordon and the Seekers and the Animals, right when the British invasion was at its height, you know, when it was at its peak, which was like 64, 65, 66. But most people don't realize, you know, I'm sure most people know this, but the British invasion kept going. It didn't stop after 66. You know, there are a lot of bands that came onto the American scene in the late 60s that, you know, represented still, you know, a form of the British invasion, sort of a strain of it that was still going on, just like kind of like how COVID's still happening. But a new strain of the British invasion kind of got started in the later part of the 60s with Cream and Led Zeppelin and a couple other groups like the Bee Gees and the Tremolos. But this was part of that strain, the new strain of the British invasion, which started to happen in the later part of the 60s, but this is probably one of the most kick-ass songs that falls into this kind of unique category of horn pop, which was huge in, you know, as far as British invasion music is concerned. It was bigger in England than it was in America, but, you know, there was a version of this genre of music, and it was, you know, made popular by a group called Love Affair, which is a vocal group that got replaced by studio musicians in the studio. But this is one of those records that is just absolutely fantastic, and it falls in that genre. And this group, you know, it's funny because, you know, the Grassroots were a big band, and I did them once before on my podcast, and they were huge in America. And the Brits are picking up on them there, and they were kind of trying to create their own version of them. But this is a really good example of that. This record sounds amazing. It is so good. It kicks ass from the first couple of seconds of it. It just hooks you in, and then you just can't help but just feel the vibes of the song. It's so catchy and so just, I mean, the groove is so hard on this record. It's just great, and I can't wait to talk about it with you guys. Okay, so this record came out in, I want to say, November, October of 1968. It's by a band called the Magic Lanterns. The name of the song is called Shame, Shame. Wow. Damn, this is a great song. Holy crap. The song's amazing. It's really, really good. The groove is really hard. The vocals are great. The musicianship on the song is really, really cool too. Man, this song is incredible. And we're going to talk about what makes the song so good, both musically and lyrically. But first, let's get into the song's music as per usual. Okay, so there's a lot going on in this song that just makes it sound incredible. When the first thing you hear in the song, you hear the bass and you hear the acoustic guitar. And when you hear the acoustic guitar happening, first of all, the acoustic guitar playing in the song is absolutely incredible. And you know, it's funny because when you think about this kind of genre of music, right? You don't really think of acoustic guitar. It's not a thing that just pops up into your brain. You think of piano, you think of organ, you think of horns, and you think of electric guitar, but not acoustic guitar. But the way the acoustic guitar player plays in the song, it just sounds amazing. I mean, his licks are just insane. He is really, really on top of his game in this song. He just sounds incredible. And another thing that's really amazing about the song is the drumming. And the drumming in the song is so, like, the drummer is so on top of the groove when it comes to everyone else in the song. I mean, his fills and the way he kind of just, you know, his energy in the song is just incredible. I mean, just the way when he transitions from, you know, hi-hat to ride, and just the fact that, and the way he interacts with the tambourine in the song is really, really cool as well. And it just, I mean, the piano especially is really cool too, because, you know, the piano player kind of plays most of the chords in the song, you know, on the bass half of the piano. But when he does that, it creates this very infectious groove that's happening. It just sounds, this record does sound amazing. And also, you know, the other cool part about the song is, you know, just even though the structure of the song is cliche, I mean, it's verse, pre-chorus, chorus, listen to how little the lyrics are in this song. There's very, very few lyrics in this song. You know, there's in the verses, there's like two lines and that's it. And then in the pre-choruses, there's just two lines. And I think the reason why they did this is because they wanted the music to kind of take over, and they didn't want a whole lot of lyrics in the song to interfere with that. So what they did is that they had the vocalist sing, like, do legato notes and do those football home notes, you know, to really establish the fact that the music was the focal point of the song and not the lyrics. So they had very, very few lyrics in the song, and they really used that to their advantage when they recorded this. They were like, okay, we're gonna have the music take over. We're gonna have the acoustic guitar sort of be the focal point in the song, and the drums, and we're gonna have that be the focal point. So the singer is not gonna sing a whole lot of lyrics. There's gonna be a lot of space for the other instruments to kind of take over and just really, really be the vocal point of the song. And the horns are a cool part of the song too, because they're really on top of everything else. I mean, shit. I mean, the horn section is just kicks ass in the song. I mean, they really just, there's a lot, this song has a lot of high energy. There's a lot of really cool things happening within the song as far as the instrumentation is concerned. The musicians kind of just let it rip. This is really a musician's song too, because even though it's a pop song, it's not like a blues R&B jam. The musicianship on the song is incredible, because you get to hear all the musicians just go nuts on this track. I mean, everyone from the bass player to the piano player to the drummer to the acoustic guitar player to the horn players, I mean, they're just going insane. I mean, this is just, and this is one of those songs where, you know, again, it's not about the lyrics, it's about the music, and you can really hear that. And also, I love how the background vocals in the song are cool too, because, you know, it's like, you know, in the chorus it is something kind of cool where there's kind of a call and response happening where they say the title and then there's a response to that, and then they kind of just and then they just kind of heighten that energy is kind of heightened once you kind of get to the second chorus, and of course that acoustic guitar solo in the after the second chorus is unbelievable, and then you hear the tambourine come in, then you hear the horns, then just hear the drummer just go with nuts with those fills, and then you kind of get back into the pre-chorus and you go to the chorus again, and God, this record is just amazing. Also, another thing to keep in mind about this record, the build-up in this track is unfucking believable. It's so good. You know, the pre-chorus build-up is just amazing, because you can just hear the tension just keep going up and up and up, and then when the chorus happens, it just explodes, and it's like, holy shit, this record is so good. I mean, it's one of those songs, and look, another thing is that, you know, another cool part about this song is the buildup in the chorus too, because it does this rising thing where it starts with the one major one chord, minor two, minor three, then it ends in the 4-5, and then when it does that, it you know, when you hear the singers going to that falsetto range, it just sounds amazing. The song is incredible, and the last minute modulation towards the end after the last chorus is so cool too, because you think the song, you kind of expect that to happen. It's not unexpected, but you kind of want it to go there anyways, because that's when the song really, really kicks ass, and then of course it ends. So there's a lot of different parts of the song that are really, really cool, and those are just some of them. You know, and you can kind of tell that maybe there are studio musicians in this song. I mean, of course, there were the horns, but it's kind of hard to say if this was the band or session players back in being musicians of the song. But either way, it just sounds really, really cool. Now let's get into the song's lyrics. So this is, again, another one of those classic love triangle songs from the 60s. There was quite a few of them. I mean, I did one on my podcast. I want to say, like, not too long ago. Late 2019, a song called Na Na Na, Hey Kiss Him Goodbye by Steam. So I've done these kind of songs before on my podcast, but it's worth talking about again, because, you know, love triangle songs are kind of interesting because they don't always take the cliche, you know, one person to another person kind of a love song thing that, you know, it's been done before a million different times. A love triangle song usually throws in a third person. That's when it gets kind of interesting, because you're dealing with three people instead of two. So let me just break down for you what's going on with the song lyrically, because there's not much to say, because, again, there's not a whole lot of lyrics. Basically, the song, it's told from a guy who is a little mad or upset that this girl that he is attracted to, you know, they were dating, but then what happened was that this other guy came in and started, and she kind of ran to him. She was attracted to him, and he's kind of mad because, you know, this guy, you know, that she likes, you know, besides him, he's a little upset because he knows that this guy isn't going to treat this girl well at all, and he's just kind of saying, you know, we had a really good thing going on, but now you're gonna go with this other guy who doesn't even love you to begin with, and is gonna basically, you know, not treat you good at all, and you should come back to me. Now, again, like, you know, this shouldn't be a new thing for you guys if you're a millennial listening to this podcast. I know there's been songs recorded recently that have this whole love triangle sort of idea. I mean, a really good example of this is "Treat You Better" by, I want to say, I'm blanking on the guy's name. I'm sorry, I'm really bad. I think it's, oh man, I can't remember his name, but I'm sure you know the song. I mean, everyone, I think most millennials know it, but it's a song called "Treat You Better." And, you know, it was a pretty big hit within the last 5 years. But it's the same exact concept of a love triangle where, a guy is mad that this girl's falling for a guy that isn't, that knows that isn't going, that he knows that, you know, is no good for her. And, you know, he knows that he could be a better boyfriend for her. And he knows that, you know, I can treat you better. And that's basically what, you know, that's the same premise of this song, really. You know, it's basically about, it's basically all about the exact same thing, where he's kind of, you know, the guy saying, hey, you should go with me instead of him, you know, and you know, it's one of those things where it's like, again, with the love triangle thing, you know, it's important to kind of just not sort of, it's very unattractive when guys tell girls what to do and kind of, they kind of boss them around. And, you know, when guys give girls advice on certain things, because they're grown women, they can kind of make their own decisions. And, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, you know, and understandably, he is feeling a little jealous, and he feels a little upset that she's going for a guy that won't really care about him. But at the same time, you know, girls kind of have to make their own decisions on certain things. And, you know, this is one of those songs that is about that. You know, and another cool part about this song is that, is that in the lyric in this song, there's some imagery happening, which is basically taken straight from, I'm pretty sure when the people that wrote this song, they were heavily influenced by that Jerry Butler song, He Don't Love You Like I Love You, because he uses, you know, in that song, Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield and Calvin Carter use the metaphor of, you know, him being a total dickhead and him not being very good to the girl. They compare that to him performing a play as an actor on a stage, and basically, and they use the exact same lyrical metaphor in this song. It's the exact same thing. I mean, literally, the second pre-chorus goes, "You called him up on the stage, but he's acting on every page." It's the exact same metaphor they use in that song, which was recorded in 1960, which was around 60 years ago this week. You know, more or less 61 years ago, but still, it's the same exact analogy. I mean, he's basically saying, "Hey, you know, he's putting on a show for you, but he's not being real or authentic with you. He's just being, you know, a slimy dickhead. He's just not being, you know, sincere with you." And that's exactly what he's saying in this song. And, you know, it's funny because in that song, again, it's the same metaphor. I mean, literally, Jerry Butler says, you know, he uses all the great quotations. He says the things I wish I could say, but he's had so many rehearsals, and to you, he's just, you know, to him, you're just another play. I mean, it's the same exact metaphor. And, you know, in this song, it's literally about the exact same thing. And it's interesting how this sort of love triangle concept, even if you're a millennial and you can relate to the song, I'm sure you can, because I'm sure if you've been around the block as far as, you know, romantic relationships is concerned, you've experienced love triangles once before in your life. But this is definitely something that could still happen today in 2021. So there's something to be said about that. But again, there's also something to be said about a lyrical concept that could still get used in modern day songs and still be pretty much something that could still get used today, even if the production values and the instrumentation of today's music is completely different from back then. The fact the lyrical concept from, you know, way back like 50, 60 years ago can still get used in popular songs today, there is definitely something to be said about that. But yeah, it's a really, really good, you know, lyrical concept, because I'm sure if you're a millennial and around my age, you'll be able to relate to that. I mean, I know that you probably have experienced that once before, but again, it's a very powerful song, not a whole lot of lyrics, because again, he's going for those football home notes. He really wants the, you know, the music to shine, and the hook is really cool too. It's just two repeated words, shame, shame, and that's really cool. And the repetition of that hook is quite awesome too, and just kind of that lyrical interplay in the chorus where it sounds kind of like a call and response thing, that's really great as well. And one more thing about the music, another cool part about that song is that right before the modulation, before the song ends, when it goes to that last chorus, it does that dum 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 dum, that triplet thing. That's really cool. I love that so much. I love how it just kicks into the high gear with that modulation with those triplets. That's really cool. Let's get into the song's history. So the Magic Lanterns are originally a group from St. Helens, and they were originally called the Sabres. They consist of Jimmy Pillsbury on lead vocals and keys, Alan Wilson on drums, Alistair Les Beveridge on rhythm guitar and vocals, Mike Osborne on bass, Pete Garner on lead guitar and vocals, Harry Paul Ward on drums and vocals, and George Lyman on bass guitar and vocals, and Pete Shoesmith on lead guitar and vocals as well, and Ian Moncur on bass guitar and vocals. So they are called the Supreme originally, and they're from St. Helens, which is 11 miles from Liverpool. And the original lineup consisted of Pete Bond on lead guitar, Keith Hope, Ken Hoban on rhythm guitar, Derek Jolly on bass, and Alan Wilson on drums. And essentially, they got together and they created a group called the Sabres. That was their original name. And basically, they went through a couple different lineup changes, you know, because they originally had a lead singer named Maurice Tickle, who was from a skippable group, the Blue Beats, and he was the original lead singer of the band. But then, and then he left the group, and basically, you know, Derek Jolly also left the group, and he got replaced by Ian Moncur. So there were quite a few different personnel changes that happened, and they were called the Sabres. And basically, you know, Peter Bond also then left the group, and then he got replaced by Joe Blackman, and then basically he then got replaced by Ken Hoban. You know, then after Ken Hoban got replaced, Vince Reno, who, by the way, which was Maurice Tickle, that going under a different name, he got replaced by Jimmy Pillsbury. And Jimmy Pillsbury wound up being the lead singer in the band. And then Gerald Backman quit the group, and then he got replaced by Peter Shoesmith. And he was from Lancashire, and he basically became the group's next lead guitar player. So you know, and then after they went into the Sabres, they changed their name to the Hammers, and then basically and they started writing a bunch of songs, you know, with Jimmy Pillsbury as a lead singer. And basically Jimmy Pillsbury wrote two original songs for the band, and that were recorded you know, for Campbell Connolly Music, which is a publishing company owned by Mike Collier. And then basically when that happened, you know, they essentially got signed to CBS Records. Now, here's a cool part about this you might not have known. CBS Records, which was actually, so it was, I always kind of talk about it as an American label, you know, because a lot of people think that, you know, CBS was an American label because they're based in New York. And they were also based in Nashville, and they also based in Los Angeles. So they were kind of spread out for most of the United States. But there was a CBS in England, and they did have you know, a different division of the same label. And I think it was actually a different label in England. It was a totally different division of CBS Records. But you know, a lot of artists that were on CBS in or Columbia EMI in England would actually wind up being on Epic in America. And these groups included the Dave Clark Five and the Yardbirds and Donovan. They were all on Columbia, which is a different imprint from EMI, but they're basically in America, they got released. They were basically released under the Epic label, with the exception of the Animals. They were actually on MGM. So they were also on Columbia EMI, but they didn't get one of on Epic Records. They wound up on MGM. So anyways, they got signed to CBS, and they actually released a song called Excuse Me Baby, which was written by Artie Wayne, and then Greedy Girl, and that single only pretty much peaked at number 44. So that didn't do very well for them. And also, the next single, Rumpelstiltskin, which was written by Peter Coap, also failed as well. And they unfortunately, you know, also had a conflicting release, because they recorded and released a version of Night in Rusty Armor at the same time as Peter and Gordon. And unfortunately, that didn't do well for them, because, you know, they unfortunately their version couldn't compete with Peter and Gordon's version, which was obviously a bigger hit. And then basically they released one more album on CBS, Lit Up with the Magic Lanterns, and they basically released a song called Auntie Griselda, which is basically, you know, with the same song that Peter Tork wrote for the Monkees. And then basically there was one more person added onto the group when they were on CBS at this time, Alistair Les Beveridge, you know, joined the group around that time when they were still on CBS. But again, a lot of these songs were not, they were failing. They were not doing well at all when they were on CBS. So they left the label after those two songs failed. And I think Your Auntie Griselda did okay for the Monkees in England. I'm not quite sure. I'll have to go look that up. I think it did okay as a single over there. It was never released as a single in America because it just sounded too weird for the Monkees at the time. But what happened was this. So they were on CBS, but then, you know, what happened is that they got picked up by Steve Roland. And Steve Roland took over as the band's manager and producer. And essentially, you know, and this song, Shame Shame, was originally released on Roland's tiny little record label that he owned called Camp. And it was recorded independently, actually in the back of a music store in London in the 60s called Chapel Music. And the name of the studio was called Chapel Studios. And that studio was located on Bond Street in London. And essentially what happened was this. It was originally released on the Tiny Camp label, but when Top of the Pop started, you know, airing the song, and when they started playing it, and, you know, when radio shows started to play the song, you know, it started to pick up steam. And then basically in America, they actually wound up getting released on Atlantic Records. And I think they were the British band to get signed to Atlantic Records, you know, at that time. Because I think the first was the Bee Gees, because they actually got picked up by ACCO, which is a subsidiary of Atlantic, still with the Atlantic family. And then after that, you know, Cream got signed. And then, you know, right when Cream got signed, right when they were starting to blow up, in at this time, you know, what happened was that they picked up this group, which was the Magic Lanterns. And essentially, and by the way, Mike Osborne was the guy who played bass on this song. And, you know, basically the musicians on it were, you know, Alistair, Les Beveridge, Mike Osborne, and Pete Garn, you know, on, you know, Alistair, Les Beveridge on rhythm guitar, Mike Osborne on bass, Pete Garner on guitar, and then basically Harry Paul Ward on drums, and then Jimmy Pillsbury on lead vocals and keys, and then Pete Shoesmith on guitar and vocals too. So basically, they all sang in the group, and this was their one and only hit in America at the time. And it peaked at number 29 the very, very end of 1968. I think the last week of 68, this was basically on the American charts. And it's funny because even though originally only peaked at number 29, and originally it did better because on WLS it actually peaked at number 5. And WLS was a huge AM radio station based in Chicago in the 60s. And a lot of hit songs that did okay, you know, nationally actually did way better regionally and were way bigger hits on WLS than they were on the national pop charts at the time. And in Canada, it actually did way better. It did peak at number 30, pick a number 3. It wins in the top 10 on the RPM charts in Canada. So obviously, this was, it did okay nationally, but regionally in other parts, and also in Canada, in other parts of the world, it, you know, regionally in America, it did way better, and in other parts of the world, it did a lot better than it did nationally on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And yeah, so that song came out, and here's another cool little piece of trivia for you. You probably didn't even know this. You know, Led Zeppelin got signed to Atlantic Records in September, October of 68, and they got signed to them via recommendation of Dusty Springfield, who played with John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page when they were playing as studio musicians in England in the 60s before Led Zeppelin even existed. Armin Erdekin was recommended to Dusty to sign the band, you know, and that's how it happened. I mean, Dusty Springfield recommended, Amit to them, you know, because she was also in Atlantic at that time. And this was late 68, because Son of a Preacher Man just came out and became a big hit. And John Paul Jones, who played bass for Led Zeppelin, is actually doing the horn chart in the song. Yeah, he arranged this whole record. And this had to have been when they were in the middle of recording their very first album. And this again, late 68, so this was just when they were picking up steam as a band, when they were just starting to, you know, get together and really hone in their skills as a group. Yeah, John Paul Jones is actually the guy who did the arrangement for the song, and that's actually pretty cool. And yeah, so after this song came out, you know, the band kind of fell apart because Ian Moncour left, you know, and came back to St. Helens. And, you know, he basically, you know, joined Harmony Street after that. And Mike Osborne, you know, actually took over as the band's new bass player. And Peter Shoesmith and Alan Wilson decided to quit as well, along with Pete Gardner, Harry and Paul Ward, you know, and they took over as new members. And this was right around the time, they record the album Shane Shane, which was produced by us. You know, they actually re-recorded it. And, you know, and that did see a release in the U.S., you know, in Atlantic, and then in Canada on Polydor. And then basically, it did okay in both countries. And then, you know, Melt All Your Troubles Away didn't even make the British charts at all. And then, you know, the One Night Stand, which was released in September 1970, you know, did better than the last single, but it didn't really chart in the UK at all. And it's funny because, you know, it's Mike Osborne. You're thinking, okay, Sam, is that Ozzy Osbourne? No, it's not. That's the funny part about it, is that, you know, you think it's Ozzy Osbourne because it's shortly before Black Sabbath, but really, no, it's not. It's just a different guy with the exact same name as the legendary Ozzy Osbourne who was in Black Sabbath. But for years after this band, you know, tanked, and after they all broke up and they did other things, you know, for years, a lot of people thought that, you know, a lot of people assumed that it was Ozzy Osbourne, but really it wasn't. It was just another guy with the exact same name as Ozzy Osbourne. You know, it's just a totally different dude though. So a lot of people thought that was Ozzy Osbourne of Black Sabbath, but really it wasn't. And basically, you know, it's funny because once the band kind of broke up, Steve Roland later went on to go work with Albert Hammond. And, you know, in the 70s, and Albert Hammond and Mike Hazlewood obviously had the huge hit in America Never Rains in Southern California, but that's besides the point. But, yeah, I mean, this is definitely, to conclude this podcast, it's just, this was kind of in the second wave of the British invasion when, you know, it was really starting to get heavy with, like, Cream and Led Zeppelin and a lot of these groups. But just if you can remember one thing, there were two sides to the second wave or the second strain of the British invasion. One side to it was the really heavy stuff like Led Zeppelin and Cream and all these really heavy bands. And then there was a more lighter stuff. And this also goes for like the Flying Machine and a lot of the studio groups that Tony Burrows was a lead singer in, like Edison Lighthouse and the group that did My Baby Loves Lovin'. And all, you know, there was a lighter side to the second wave of the British invasion. You know, and basically this was all happening the very end of the 60s. And the Magic Lanterns were very much a part of the lighter side of the British invasion, the second wave of the British invasion, and they weren't really part of the heavy side, but like Cream and Led Zeppelin. And of course, the Foundations were part of the lighter side of the second wave of the British invasion too. And there were other groups that were also like that, like the Flying Machine and a couple of other bands, like Edison Lighthouse, and you know, just more or less studio groups. You know, not real bands. Although I think the Flying Machine was a real group. But then there were other groups, like I said before, like Love Affair, and I think his name was Jeffrey, the song guy to the song Come On, Maybe Let Me Take You in Your Arms. He was another part of, good example, the lighter side of the British, the second wave of the British invasion that started like in 67, 68, but yeah. So that concludes episode number 129 of my Sick Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you like my analysis on this week's song, you thought it was cool, and you've never heard the song before, and I'm like, holy shit, this is great. And you've also learned a lot of interesting facts about this week's song. You never knew anything about it before, like the Led Zeppelin connection with the song. Please email me at samltwilliatcloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies, and check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. By the way, one more thing. I think this is the last song that John Paul Jones worked on as an arranger right when he was recording the first Led Zeppelin album with Jimmy Page and John Bonham and Robert Plant. This was like the last thing he did, you know, as a side musician before he joined Led Zeppelin full time. And yeah, so that's really cool. So please reach out to me if you heard this podcast and you liked my analysis on this week's song, or you just learned so much about this song and you never really knew anything about it, learned some really cool facts behind it. Please reach out to me. Email me at samltwilliatcloud.com. Also, you can check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net, and you can also check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. You'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about my show so far, including some of the ones I've mentioned in interview episodes. We really, really appreciate it if you can go check that out. Also, another thing you can check out is the official is my two song single that's out right now. You know, it's under my new name, Sam L. Williams. Turquoise Apricots on the A side, Cheese and Nose on the B side. Link to that is in the description of this week's episode of this podcast, where you'll find it on some of the stream platforms it's on. You know, love you can check that out. Please let me know what you think of it, samltwilliamcloud.com. You can email me on the email address, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram, IROLIES. You can also check out the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast. There you'll be able to find this a really, really cool, you know, merch logo that's specific for this podcast. It's the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode. Keep on trucking, tight font with the name of the podcast on the bottom. Love you can check that out. If you liked that logo and thought it was cool, and you would like to support my podcast by purchasing an item from the store, please let me know by emailing me at samltwilliamcloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartWillies. But I would appreciate any sort of feedback you might have for the logo and also the prices of each item in the store. You can also do that by emailing me at samltwilliamcloud.com. That would be really, really cool. And again, thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of this podcast. Hopefully it wasn't too long for you and you could digest it. I might be doing another kind of short one next week and do another cool little one-hit wonder, just a completely different genre of music. Or if I do another two-part, I'll make sure that both parts are no longer than like 30, 35 minutes. But anyway, so thanks you guys for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things moving.